Session number 12879, Captain Eric Winkle Brown, Reel 3.
So it was considered necessary to have a look to see what their characteristics were going to be, because as you're well aware, it was intended to put jet engines on the Tudor, and eventually they were, and it became the Ashton. So this was the reason the transonic testing was being done, and that was quite an exciting event, because the stick forces involved in a big airplane like that, of course, in transonic changes of trim. Compressibility changes of trim are very large, and we had to brief two pilots, myself and my co-pilot, to be, if I wanted help, we had a code of signals ready to give the necessary pushes or whatever, because already one had a two-handed job going on. We weren't able to move the throttles, so the second pilot usually had to deal with the throttles and then try and give you aid on the second stick. And I think we were recording some pulls were of the order of 80 pounds. It's a lot of pulling.
What about the Halifax troubles? So you were on
I was only on, and when you say Halifax troubles, the one I was involved in was the question of their problems associated with corkscrewing evasive manoeuvres over Germany. There were a number of reports coming back from aircrew that they had seen Halifaxes going in steep spirals. Of course, on night operations. And it was decided that this was happening. The reports were becoming so frequent, we thought we'd better have a look, just see what was involved. And that was not a compressibility problem. No. It was a straightforward problem of the corkscrew maneuver was such that the idea was to pull the aircraft up and turn violently at the same time. And some of the crew were cutting an engine to aid the turn. And was such that the idea was to pull the aircraft up and turn violently at the same time. And some of the crew were cutting an engine to aid the turn. And we found that
this was for evasive action.
Yes, it was for evasive action when you were either in searchlights or a fighter was chasing you, either or. Now, the cutting of an engine had a fairly violent effect on the making the wing drop, losing lift on one side when you cut that engine. And I think many of the people didn't appreciate quite how violent this effect could be. And you could get yourself into a position where you would probably have got your attitude into such a situation that you toppled your artificial horizon or your blind flying instruments, in other words. So you had no reference other than outside reference, basically. Since you're outside reference on a pitch black night and in searchlights is never very good anyway, this could well account for the disaster. And I had the good fortune to take up the very famous chap who runs the home, so
Cheshire.
Group Captain Cheshire, yes, and he had, that time, of course, was at the peak of his powers and as a bomber pilot. And He was well renowned for his very, very press-on attitude. And he came up with me that night when we flew from Farnborough, and just to make sure that I was doing what he believed were the practices that were being used in the squadrons. And it was quite clear then that he himself was a very good pilot, and he would cut the engine probably in such a way that he was controlling the situation all the way through. But if you got a younger pilot, not without his experience, and was maybe handling the thing a little harshly, and the situation under dire stress, of course, you were in enemy territory under attack, it was easy to see how the situation could rapidly develop from a controlled situation into a disastrously uncontrolled situation. There was very fine balance. And when you get as big an aeroplane as this and it does get out of control, you need an awful lot of height to get it back into control. This is the problem. It loses a tremendous amount of height.
That's why they altered the shape of the fins, that they're on the
That's correct. And also, this is the other point, it was to aggravate this engine cutting, it also had what's called rudder over balance. In other words, when you're corkscrewing, you're not only using your ailerons and your elevator, you also can use violent rudder movements. And when you push hard on the rudder and you could get full rudder on in these circumstances, and the aircraft was skidding, as you had almost two-thirds travel on, it would suddenly move over the other third itself and lock. Now the pressure required foot load to get that back was so high that it would have needed two people to do it. Now the Halifaxes, as you know, it was in our situation, we didn't have co-pilots in those days, there were flight engineers. And the foot load was probably too much for one man. So once you got into this question of pulling an engine back, getting a roll on because you'd lost lift, and you got rudder over balance at the same time, you really had a fatal combination.
Going back, I mean, you know Germany and German flight developments and people very well. Who are the main German engineers, you think, who brought the state of the art to such a high level of development at the end of the war? I mean, there was Lippisch and his Deltas, and he designed
yes.
the Comet, didn't he?
Lippisch was a remarkable man in many ways, but he wasn't the R.T. Mitchell of Germany. Kurt Tank, I think, was the man that I would put on a par with R.T. Mitchell. He was the chief designer for Focke-Wulf. Now, he was a remarkable man in many ways, because not only was he the chief designer, he did all the initial flight in his own designs. So he was a qualified test pilot and he was really very highly thought of, very, very fertile brain, and of course he produced some magnificent aircraft, the Focke-Wulf 190. I always think of the war in this sense: if there were three aircraft that came out on either side, I would put the Focke-Wulf 190 as one of the big ones, the Ju-88. And the ME-262 as the three German ones that I would choose. And on the British side, the Spitfire, the Mosquito, and the Lancaster. Now, all these six aircraft were magnificent aircraft, all of them. And Kurt Tank was the producer of the 190. Now, the 262 was Willy Messerschmitt's, but Willy Messerschmitt, I would put in the same category as Tank in the sense that the 262 was way ahead of its time. It had sweep back, of course, much of that information came out of the German research establishments as opposed to out of the aircraft's own research department, so to speak. It came out of the national resource as opposed to the company resource.
Where was that? Peenemünde?
Some at Peenemünde, a lot done at Brunswick, but mostly done at Göttingen. And the 262 had a lot of design control and stability characteristics that were masked by its marvelous performance. But it wasn't really a beautiful aeroplane to fly in some ways. It had problems, and it could be a very lethal machine, for example, if one had an engine failure on takeoff. Now, the Focke-Wulf 190 was a delightful aeroplane in every sense of the word. It barely had a fault. It had a fairly vigorous stall, but apart from that, it was almost as perfect as the Spitfire. So Kurt Tank, I think, first and foremost. When you go onto the bomber side, I think the Junkers team, we didn't have much to do with them, of course, because most of them were trapped in the Russian zone after the war. Dr. Heinkel, I spoke to quite a lot. Strange, interesting man, because, as you know, he was a Jew, and he was...
I didn't know, actually.
Yes, and he was preserved because, I presume, of his usefulness to the regime. But he had a lot of administrative troubles, probably because of that aspect. But he did design some very fine aircraft, some research aircraft. The very first jet, of course, that ever flew was Heinkel's. He had a disastrous aircraft, of course, in the Heinkel 177. But that was designed not so much under the direct aegis of Heinkel as under a consortium of designers who were working for his firm. And he was very scathing himself about this particular aircraft. I would say if Germany's real strength lay in their research establishments like Göttingen, as I say, in Brunswick, this is where the real power lay. Just as much of the power of this country, of course, lay in the RAE Farnborough. If you were in any trouble or any stage of the design process, you had to come to Farnborough, which was the fount of all knowledge, really, in this country for anything aeronautical. And when you look at the men who were at Farnborough in the war years, it's like a who's who of British aviation, or almost of world aviation. Huge names. And they carried on, and much of their expertise, the part, for example, that Farnborough played in Concorde, design of Concorde, is immense. And much of that came from the team who were there in the war years. They'd all become senior by this time, but nevertheless it carried on through.
Were there many Germans from post-war years?
Oh yes, after the war a considerable number of Germans were taken on at Farnborough, and many of them extremely distinguished, like Dr. Kuchen, for example, who's now gone back to Brunswick, I think. Yes.
Didn't he design the Ergonomal wing of Concorde?
That's right. That's right. And we picked out quite a number, and many of them decided voluntarily to stay on. Of course, they were pressed into duty at Farnborough to begin with, but then came the period when they were free to go either way, and many of them decided to stay on in this environment because they were true. They weren't interested in the political situation at the time. They were true scientists. Like, I think one of the most interesting men I've ever met in my life is Werner von Braun, who is a true scientist. I'm not hinting that he was disloyal to his country. On the contrary. But what I'm saying is he was so much involved in the advance of science that he would almost have worked for anybody that would have given them the facilities to progress his thinking and his ideas. He was the pure scientist, motivated only by a desire to advance the progress of the knowledge of mankind. Remarkable man.
Rather like Krupp in a similar kind of way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Had to build guns, didn't matter who they were for.
Right. Yeah. Remarkable man, I think.
What about Busemann? Is he still around? Or?
Who?
Busemann.
Not to my knowledge. He may be. I haven't heard anything.
Who are the people who are still around who I might go and talk to on this kind of theme? Are anyone at Göttingen
in
still?
Germany?
Yeah.
Yes, I would try. I would go and talk to Kuhn if I were you.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's well worth.
Yeah.
Worth that word. And the, of course, there's Hannah Reich, but I doubt whether you'll ever get in contact with her. She avoids contact in many ways because, you know, Hannah was a fanatic. And I think she wants to leave that image as far away as she can.
The BBC had her in this series.
Yes, I don't know how they got hold of her. Somebody must have brought a lot of pressure to bear. But it's very rare you can get Hannah to open her mouth. She's very elusive, too. I think she's in Ghana at the moment. But she plays it very low key. She was a remarkable woman. Quite. But you see, the Germans had, apart from Hannah Reich, this is the interesting thing, they had no Great Dane test pilots. They moved their people around. I think this was one of the weaknesses of their system. Maybe they killed a lot of them, I'm not sure, but they, we had what one might call name test pilots in this country that were known to the industry, known to the public. This was not the case in Germany at all. When one met the Arado test pilot, one had never heard of him till he was captured. One never heard of the Messerschmitt test pilot even once the, of course, Wendel, who was their chief test pilot when the famous world speed record was made on the 109. He stayed with them for a while, but he did, I think, 3 flights of the 262, and then that he retired. But following him, we never heard of who the chief test pilot was for Messerschmitt. And often, it was just a squadron commander plucked out of the Luftwaffe and thrown into the game. And this, I think, partly accounts for comment I made earlier that they didn't seem to be pursuing any transonic testing. I don't think they had anybody with the experience to pursue it. They had no trained test pilots. They had a place at Rechlin, of course, which was supposed to be an equivalent to Farnborough, but it was it was not really comparable at all. So that was, I think this was one of their problem areas. They had a lot of development troubles on their prototypes, a lot of crashes on their prototypes. Once more, I think partially because they had no real skilled pilots. They didn't have a test pilot school. Well, neither did we in this country till about 1944 when it was set up, but it's paid big dividends since. Now, the seat of the pants flying will get you so far, but you really have to train a pilot to. Well, not so much. It's not only training, it's detecting whether he's the right material to persevere with.
And then cultivating him.
That's right. There is little point in persevering with a person who obviously hasn't got an analytical mind or has some shortcoming which will make him just not the right material for the game. I'm a great believer that the really good test pilots are born this way, and their qualities are brought out by their training. They're not imbued in them by their training. So it's a question of selection. And many of these people that I know were, in fact, came from backgrounds which really gave no hint that they were going to be good test pilots at all. You take a chap like Bill Humble of Hawkers. Now, Bill was the son of a fairly wealthy coal mine owner, as I recollect it, up in Yorkshire, and he did a lot of private flying and that type of thing. Alec Henshaw, very similar background.
But they had that quality about them that made it obvious that they were a bit above the average. In the whole run of pilots, somebody spotted that, and they were given the training, and they turned out to be crackerjacks. This is how it goes.
It's interesting. I was talking to Philip Lucas a couple of weeks back, and he was telling me how he got Rosie Beaumont on the staff, you know, purely as a sort of production test pilot, to help him out.
Yes.
And the qualities came out then. Then he got captured towards the end of the war.
Well, yes, of course, Beaumont really arrived rather late in the scene. The first I really recollect of Beaumont coming into the business was really well post-war, when they got into the jet giver. But he did a great job in the Canberra and on the TSR-2. But if you asked me who the best one I've seen, or the most gifted one I've seen, is, I think, the Saunders Roe.
Jeff Tyson.
I think he's the most gifted, purely gifted aviator I've seen, in the sense that he had that touch. It's like watching Borg play tennis. He's just got that touch, which is the touch of the master about him. I had tremendous respect for Tyson. Now, you see, he was picked up into test flying in the same way. He was in the Alan Cobham Air Circus, and it was obvious from the stunts he got up to there that he was, well, almost a unique sort of aviator. And he came into the game that way. Now, I am not sure that when you set up thing like the Empire Test Pilot School, this is a very interesting sort of situation where you have an intake that's picked up from the services. I presume they do their own selection. They then go through a selection process in the school. Well, before they go to the school itself, they then go through the school, and they've produced good pilots, there's no question about that. But somehow they don't seem to have produced the personalities. Maybe it's not nothing to do with school, maybe it's just that the test flying game has differed so much. It's not so qualitative as it used to be. That's probably the answer. It's more quantitative now. You're up with a load of ironmongery, which is all doing the work, recording everything for you. The qualitative assessment, I think, probably counts less than the quantitative data which is being picked up during the flight.
You were talking earlier on about the immense amount of sort of manual mathematics that had to be gone through in the old days. Now you've got computers, but you're no quicker in getting an aircraft into service. In fact, you're a lot slower. I mean, I know the avionics come into it here.
That is true. I think the avionics, you're in regions of advanced technology too now, which are much more difficult. I mean, we're flying at heights which one never dreamt of 20 years ago. We're flying at speeds, taking us into the thermal barrier now, and that in itself is a problem. I think the stresses on the human body are so much higher that this is another reason that people are possibly going a bit more cautiously. One of the astonishing things to me is the growth of this science of ergonomics, which has come up now, where they study all the aspects of human frailty, if you like, involved in flying an airplane. The RAF Institute of Aviation Medicine really is playing quite a powerful part now, has in the matter of design and operational techniques. And this is virtually a new science that's come into the game. So while as I would agree with you that things haven't changed, what I would say is that you would have expected, if the old system had remained, they'd have taken much longer as the technology got more difficult, more advanced. The fact that they're staying in the same time scale as before in itself is a tribute to the modern computer that's managed to contain it this way. Otherwise, it may have taken three times as long.
Well,
of course, about the time. But when you have an investment now, and each piece of machinery costs such an enormous amount of money, I think the flight testing is far more thorough. And they take more time in that sense, but the methods they have manage to keep this time within bounds. For example, I went down to see them testing the Sikorsky S-76 helicopter. And there they have the pilot does a maneuver. They get a readout, instantaneous readout, sitting down in the flight test center, and they analyze it there and then and tell him if he can go on with the next maneuver and how far he can go. You see, now in my day, you've got a list of things to do. And you went through them, and then they decided if they would go on, how far they would go from that. If anything went wrong on that list, well, too bad. But there was no way of taking it so gradually, otherwise we'd have been there forever. And I think the risk element, to a large extent, has been eliminated by this new method of readback, instantaneous readback and analysis.
Because you don't hear of so many test pilot fatalities now. I mean, the Tornado engine has gone in. Now, that's the first British test pilot I've heard.
For a long, long time.
Whereas in the 50s,
that's right.
Every other month.
That's
one.
Right.
Yeah. My brother-in-law was one.
You're quite right. And I think this is the reason. Because
and
the
I think Tocqueville is another thing. I mean, when you think what a huge quantum jump that was to bring a supersonic aircraft into passenger service. We haven't got a bomber. I mean, normally you try that out on military
really
people first, where the risk is acceptable. But as a commercial flight, with all the rigors of commercial certification in every country, including America.
Trubshaw is an interesting chap because he spans the what I call, well, almost the old school into the new school. And as a Concorde test pilot, I mean, he must find himself now very much being mastered by all this equipment. The bag tells him precisely what to do and where to go and what not. In the end, of course, everybody will always argue, and I think quite rightly, that if things really go wrong, no computer in the world can beat the human brain. But that's not how they're trained these days. The training has... There's a completely different orientation in test pilot training now. There's so much more accent on understanding what I might call the almost the mathematical solutions to the problem, as well as just how to handle the situation. But of course, there is qualitative assessment that has to be done, and they are trained for that. But it just doesn't play the same prominent part that it used to play. I'm not arguing that either method is better. I think we have accepted that there must be a change because of the change in the technology and the change in the cost of the machine. It's got to be dealt with in a very different way. There are less mistakes, too, made in basic design than there used to be before, because the designers now, there's no one designer like the big names of old. There's a team of designers with a project leader or a project member.
You've got multiple fail-safes.
That's right.
Yeah.
And you don't hear so-and-so as the Hawker designer or so-and-so as the de Havilland designer, like it used to be in the old days. There was one man, the chief designer.
Fozzard, of course, is a bit of a personality.
Oh, yes, he was very much involved in the Harrier. See, but the Harrier was still there in Cam's day. And there's the Hawk, sense, but the Hawks are more of a team effort, I think. There is always, of course, key personalities involved, but I'm saying that they don't seem to have the same power focused into them within the firm like they used to have. And everybody knew Petter was the chief designer of General Electric. Everybody knew Bishop was the chief designer of De Havilland's Sydney camp, and Mitchell originally, and then Smith at Supermarines. They were big names in the game. It's like the same thing has happened up to a point in Hollywood. Star roles,
no, you can star directors now.
Yeah, that's right.
So I don't